Hello, and welcome to this edition of the Fair Data Podcast, where we discuss all things fair, making data findable, accessible, interoperable, and reusable. I'm Rory McNeil, host of the Fair Data Podcast, and my guest today is Sharif Islam. Sharif works as a data architect at Naturalis Biodiversity Center in Leiden, the Netherlands, where he forms the technical and strategic link between international projects and Naturalis. One of these projects is DISCO, Distributed System of Scientific Collections, a new pan-European project that involves working with European museums and natural science collections to create data-driven and fair research infrastructure. Sharif, welcome. It's great to have you on the podcast.
Hi, Rory. Yeah, thank you for inviting me. It's great to be here as well.
Excellent. So before we get into your current activities from your base in Leiden, tell us a bit about the first stage of what seems to me to be turning into a fascinating career journey. That was in supercomputing at the University of Illinois and then at the National Supercomputing Center in Urbana.
Yes. I was involved there with a project called the Blue Waters Supercomputing. So that was one of the most largest and powerful supercomputers built with the National Science Foundation funding. And the history behind NCSA is it was one of the five supercomputing centers that was built in the 80s, another big NSF involvement. And then Mosaic was built there as well. That was one of the big famous things that came out of NCSA, which became Netscape and the browser and things like that, sort of the very early innovation during the internet. And a lot of research around scientific computing. And the big idea behind Blue Waters was what we called then the petascale computing. Now we're moving into exascale. So petascale is sort of quadrillion operations per second. So that's kind of the scale we're talking about. And one of the exciting challenges of the project was to, I was mostly on the system design and operations side. So basically we had a team of developers and system engineers that was basically responsible for making the system running, operational, supporting a wide variety of science use cases, and to make sure that everybody, and it was a shared system, so we need to make sure that those jobs that run on those machines can perform well and produce the result that the scientist was interested in. So yeah, it was a really, really fun project, and I really liked working there.
Yeah, fantastic. Now you're obviously doing things slightly differently, or you're at DISCO, but do you find that the supercomputing experience you had, is it relevant to the work that you're doing at DISCO? And tell us a little bit about what DISCO involves.
Yeah. I think some of the challenges we have in any system and data designer are common. I mean, you have to make sure that, different components are working together, your data moving from one system to another, things are running properly, you need to observe, monitor, there's aspect of log management, file management, and things like that. So those things are common in any system. And the supercomputer is probably, the scale is a little bit different. I mean, we were dealing with, thousands of compute nodes, terabytes of data. So that scale is probably not there right now for me. However, the problems are the same. And of course, the users, the scientists that we work with, those are, they're basically an interface for the machines, to get their work done. So those aspects are also similar. So the DISCO project, what we're doing right now, so it's a large-scale European-funded project. We're trying to build a research infrastructure for natural science collections data. So these are scientific specimens that are stored in natural history museums, botanical gardens, and other collection holding institutes. So we're working with more than 20 different countries in Europe and 170 plus organizations that will be part of this project. So we are in the preparatory phase. We're still in the design and testing, and probably in the next few years, we will apply for a legal entity and will become a operational service. So we still have quite a way to go. But the big idea is that all of this specimen data, the physical objects that we have in the museums, are enormous source of information for scientists, not just for taxonomy or morphology or biology, but for sequence data, for other interesting understanding of historical aspect of biodiversity. So all of this becomes sort of a data point that connects everything. And a lot of digitization has been happening over the years. A lot of databases, a lot of things are online. However, a lot of integration is missing. So that's where this idea of research infrastructure comes in. So that's sort of the starting component. However, along with that, we will provide a lot of support for digitization for all of those museums, training, capacity building, and more supporting data-driven use of these specimens and specimen-related data. So taking this data sort of in the next level to make research much more easier using the data coming out of the specimens and connecting with other data sets from other infrastructures as well.
Yeah, I think I remember hearing you speak a little bit about this at the recent FAIR Digital Objects Forum, and I was really fascinated by how the kind of dead things in museums can actually have a living component, so to speak, through the digitization, but also like through things that looking at their DNA, for example, and things like that can actually then interface with kind of things which I think most people would think of as being more kind of active things than the kind of things you see in museums. So that's a really fascinating project, as well as the scale, of course, I'm sure the scale must provide lots of challenges since it's such a big project.
Yeah. So I think one estimate currently that there's almost 1.5 billion objects like this in the museums, and not everything is digitized, and there's different level of digitization. Some have images, some have sounds, some has only metadata. So we still have quite a way to go for this. However, we also need to be pragmatic about it. So for example, during the pandemic, there were a lot of interest in specimens that was collected during the previous pandemic. People were very interested in bat specimens and other hosts that can transmit virus and things like that. So suddenly those specimens became very valuable and interesting for researchers. So then priority sort of shifted that, okay, we need to focus on that. So those things will be helping us to understand what needs to be digitized in what level and who needs what. So a lot of use case driven approach as well.
Yeah. Great. So another project you're currently involved in, as I understand it, is BioDT, and I think that directly involves supercomputing. Is that right?
Yes. So BioDT is another European funded project, Biodiversity Digital Twin, and the goal is to create a digital twin for biodiversity related data, and use it for real dynamic decision making. And the one way to think about digital twin is it's a virtual representation of the real world entities and processes that can be synchronized, and you can probably decide on the precision and fidelity that you want to get those synchronization. So it's still in a very early stage. So in this project, we will deliver a prototype for this digital twin. And there's a large European project called Destination Earth that will combine a lot of these different types of digital twin and create a model of digital twin for the whole Earth. And here we're working with several different data sets from wide variety of spaces, from not just biodiversity, ecology, climate, sort of coming in together to make this digital twin. And the supercomputing is there to figure out, how, when we have this computational heavy processes, how that can help us. So that's where some of these data elements will come in to create the digital twin and go to the supercomputer and give results. Yeah.
Wow. Fascinating. So helping to translate FAIR concepts into practice it sounds like a key aspect of, in particular, as you were describing DISCO, it struck me, but also BioDT, no doubt. Let's talk a bit more generally about FAIR and how FAIR can be implemented, how we go from principles and strategy to action. So what are some of the key areas that you think need to be focused on and need support in terms of funding?
Yeah, thank you. I think that is a very important question, because FAIR has been, as a concept, has been around for several years. If you look at the citation of the FAIR paper, it's been cited in more than 5,000, 6,000 times. So people are at least aware of these things and reading about it and learning about it. So the implementation is a slightly different thing, because then you have to deal with practicality, funding. So I think two key aspect I would highlight is, of course, the training and the metadata. So the training basically helps you to think about what exactly FAIR means, because it's a gradient. It's sort of a not a binary thing. You know, you go through different steps of FAIR maturation. So that training helps. But for that training, you need organizational support. You need people that can train you. So those aspects will come in. And one of the outcome for the training would be to understand, for example, metadata. What does metadata mean? We all talk about metadata a lot, but sometimes, you know, you need to understand why is it important. And it's very context specific. So a very minimal metadata in one context might not make sense in another context. So those things also need to be very use case dependent. So if you combine some of these things, you kind of have this sort of basic framework that you can build on. Then you can build a discovery layer for your metadata. Then you can connect your metadata to the actual data stream and other things. So that's where sort of the system component comes in. But I think the training is really important to get those systems useful.
Interesting. So, and how does that tie in with, because there's, as I look at things, there's a lot of training going on for another aspect is data stewards. Data stewards are coming into play. And then there's different kinds of data stewards. There are kind of general data stewards who maybe I think initially the concept was they would need to help people get things into repositories. So that's kind of data curation, kind of generalist data curation. Then there are other increasingly data stewards are being embedded in projects, and those data stewards might well have a PhD in whatever the relevant subject matter is. So they're subject matter specific data stewards. It sounds to me like you're envisioning kind of a third category of not necessarily of person, you know, of role, but a third category of knowledge, which is around metadata and a more of a kind of technical training and technical things relating to metadata and other aspects of FAIR. Is that right?
Yeah, I think possibly. Yeah, I think that's a nice way to put it. Yeah, I think the domain knowledge is definitely important. I mean, if you have the domain knowledge, that you can help your user better. But sometimes also understanding, for example, some of the common themes that happens. So, for example, in a large organization like Naturalis or in a university, you will be supporting a variety of different use cases. So sometimes it's not practical to have sort of one specialist for one domain. So then you kind of figure out what are the common elements in that. So everybody has problem with the repositories. Everybody needs to have an identifier. So those common elements will get you to more infrastructure and system level thinking.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's a nice way to think about that. Yeah.
Yeah.
But the data stewards, I think, are very crucial in FAIR implementation. And more and more, at least in the Netherlands, we're seeing more and more organizations are supporting. There's actually a decent profile of these jobs now. There's a path, you know, to become a data steward and progress in job and get the recognition. So slowly these things are happening. And that's very important. Yeah,
absolutely. And I think it's fair to say the Netherlands is, and as far as I can see, is leading the world in terms of these things that you're describing. So it's interesting. I think it's interesting to see how things play out in the Netherlands, because that's probably the Netherlands is working out the opportunities and the problems of these things like recognition, as well as different kinds of data stewards, all these things. So yeah, so it's so being enlightened is not a bad place from which to observe and participate these developments, I think. So
yeah.
So, I mean, you just mentioned metadata, but if kind of generally, if you had to single out two or three key technical foundations for FAIR or FAIRifying data, what would they be?
Yes, I think I would highlight three things. Persistent identifiers are definitely one of the key things that you'll see in every FAIR implementation mentioned. So these are identifiers like DOI, handle, and other variety of identifiers that makes your resources findable through either a HTTP link or other mechanisms. And they have to be globally unique within that system, so to make sure that you know, you can get to the content. But that requires an infrastructure behind it. So, for example, DOI Foundation and the organizations behind the handle systems and other persistent identifiers actually have organization behind it. And we can talk about that later as well, what that means. And then again, I will bring out metadata again, because there are metadata associated with those persistent identifiers and your content, and that needs to be findable. So if you just create a persistent identifier and just, you know, send it out to the digital void, expect people to just magically find it, that's not going to happen. So you need enough viable metadata that can help you. And that where some of these other services come in. So you'll probably need a catalog or search portal that can get those metadata and point to the content. And the third thing I'll mention is open standards and well-documented API. So API is a very nice way to glue things together. I mean, of course, you know, we all like portals and human interface, but when we talk about machine-to-machine interactions, if you have a well-documented and open standard-based API, that helps a lot to share data, connect mm-hmm. data, and make those data useful. So those are the three technical things that can come to my mind to have a base to create some of these infrastructures.
Yeah, excellent. I think that those are sound right on the mark to me, and I think it's actually really useful, because there is, as you say, there is so much discussion around FAIR, and it means so many different things to different people, and it's not possible to keep up with all the different kinds of activity that are going on. It's incredibly mm-hmm. exciting, but it can also be a bit overwhelming. So I mean, those things as kind of foundation benchmarks to me sound it right on the mark, and it's good. At least it helps me in kind of keeping grounded in my thinking about what are the key things. So thank you. That's excellent. I'm sure people will find those useful. So here's something I've been reflecting on since the Fair Digital Objects Forum, whenever it was, 6 weeks ago or so, and I'd love to get your reaction. So as I was listening to the presentations and having conversations with people, there did seem to be something of a disconnect between the highly technical because I had these conversations and highly technical, but also to many people involved in research data management and open science, somewhat abstruse, the technical development and discussion around FAIR digital objects. A disconnect between that and then the much broader range of activities that are expanding every day relating to general verification of data. I'm just curious, do you think that disconnect is, was I just imagining things? Did you see that as well? Is that something you've had conversations about with other people?
Yes, no, I think that's something within the FAIR Digital Object Forum we have recognized, and I think during the conference it came out, you know, and helped us also put some impetus on it and think about it a little bit more carefully. And actually, a couple of weeks ago, we did a small Q&A webinar where we called it "Everything You Wanted to Ask About FDO and Afraid to Ask," something like that. We had a nice webinar where we invited community to ask questions. And I think one of the reasons for this disconnection is that, so the history behind some of this work we're doing with the FAIR Digital Objects coming from RDA, the Research Data Alliance, and other venues where, you know, you have different expertise, sort of thinking about data model, thinking about FAIR. So some of the discussions came out from that. And usually these are, oftentimes you volunteer for some of these efforts. So you have, you know, sort of extra time, or you figure out some way to thinking about it. But that makes those discussions a little bit slow, because, you know, you have to organize yourselves, other group, find people that can understand things. And then you get into the details of data model, you know, data governance, or how things get. So that's where some of those technical jargons and obtuseness come in, because, you know, you have to focus on the details. And because, you know, we're kind of doing these things on the side, we don't have enough time, some time to figure out all of those nitty-gritty details and the communication. You know, most of the time the data experts are focusing on the data element and the interoperability aspect. They're not thinking about the presentation and the communication. So I think that's where some of this disconnection come in. And I think we're aware of it, and we're thinking about how to make this kind of effort sustainable. So there will be a lot of focus on funding this kind of efforts, and that will help us to bring in people that are good with communicating these ideas, making those disconnection a little bit easier to help make that bridge.
Yeah, you know, that's good to hear. And also I thought the fact of the Fair Digital Objects Forum was a real experiment. I thought it was fantastic. It was a real kind of experimental. The conference itself, the way it was run, was kind of a big experiment, which was great. And it was and having those, the fact that something like that disconnect would actually came out into the open and people were talking about it is really positive, I would say. Yeah. And the fact that you're now moving to address it is also positive. So it's a fascinating to kind of watch how these things are developing. So, I mean, you kind of have a very interesting cross-Atlantic or perspective, because you spent a lot of time doing the supercomputing in the U.S. and now you've been in the Netherlands for a number of years, and you're involved in the kind of things we've been discussing. And certainly there were some participants in, for example, in the Fair Digital Objects Forum from the U.S. And there's lots of fair activity in the U.S. But do you have any sense or perspective on how the kind of projects that you're involved in with DISCO and things like that in Europe, do they have counterparts in the U.S. or you know, are you aware of how do you kind of think of the comparative development of FAIR, let's say, in North America and Europe?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. So the FAIR concept started in Europe. Actually, the conference that launched the FAIR paper was from Leiden, not too far from where I'm sitting right now. So that has historically that gave a little bit more emphasis on the European participants and European projects. However, in the last several years, National Science Foundation in the US and other funding agencies in North America is also providing a lot of funding for FAIR data. And in the broader concept, there's also this idea of open data. So that conversation has been going on for a long time. Not necessarily they're the same. I mean, not all open data are FAIR and vice versa. So you have to keep that in mind. So we do have in the DISCO ecosystem and within biodiversity, we also have a lot of collaborators in the US and also in other parts of the world, in China and Brazil and India. So we're also thinking of these as a much more global effort as well. But however, I think comparing the funding aspect and sort of the progress in the technical implementation, I think the European projects are a little bit ahead because, you know, they had a head start and they had more conversation on it. They're more research infrastructure type projects in national level and also in European level that has FAIR as a focus. So at the moment, I don't see that clearly in some of the North American projects. But however, it's changing. I think more and more people are understanding sort of the benefit of these concepts. So even though maybe they have done it, but they have probably not called it FAIR. So there's also some of those practices, we have to recognize that, you know, so that some of this idea of linking data interoperability was there. So FAIR sort of in a way encapsulated in a principle that is easy to understand.
Right. Yeah. And I suppose, of course, EOSC, all the many, many, the huge amount of funding and all the activities that are either stimulated by or directly funded by EOSC is also a big stimulus to more activity around FAIR in Europe, which you don't have anything comparable to that in the US. So,
I mean, maybe the political situation makes it a little bit easier in the US, because here, when you get to the European projects, then sometime, you know, the national interest and the European interest, you know, sometime collides, or you have to align those things a little bit differently than, let's say, you know, you're working with five different big universities in the US. You know, so I mean, you will have some state level and federal level issues, but it's a very different way of thinking about politically there than here. So sometimes it's maybe easier
in the US. Yeah, interesting. Yeah. As you say. So if maybe the US takes a bit longer, but when the NSF or the NIH gets behind something, then it's big and it's for everyone. So yeah, and good point. Yep. All right. So last topic. So I know that open infrastructure is another area of interest for you. Could you talk to that a bit? What are the defining characteristics of open infrastructure, and could you give us a couple of examples?
Yes, so I think especially when we're talking about scholarly research infrastructure, and the idea of open infrastructure is very, very crucial. And one of the, and there's a lot of definition. I mean, you can also think about what you mean by infrastructure. I mean, is it, for example, is a web portal infrastructure and things like that. So there's a lot of different ways of understanding. But one way to think about it is that you have to provide a sort of a sustainable service to the community. So that's where the two components come in. You're sustainable, you're providing service, and then you have a community engagement and component. And in a way, you can think of it as a socio-technical system. So open infrastructure is not you install something and you just put it out there and you hope that it will be working. So you need to think about the policy, the governance, and the how you organize that. And of course, making it sustainable for the future is also important. So that's where I think some of the common theme I see in different discussions about open infrastructure. And if you get a little bit broader outside of the scholarly domain, there's also now a lot of talk about digital commons, digital public spaces. I mean, the last several months, the whole the fiasco that happened and with Twitter, everybody started thinking about, oh, how do we understand a digital common space for people? Do we need to rely on big platforms and things like that? So I think they are very related issues because we see similar conversation in the research domain as well. Like, you know, who will build this infrastructure? Who will support them? So two good examples I can give right now. For example, the DOI Foundation, the whole DOI ecosystem is a good example of open infrastructure. You know, they have protocols, standards that are open. You can find them. They have governance and funding scheme behind the organization. So that's where some of the sustainability comes in. And they also have, you know, interactions with the community that using those persistent identifier. And another good example would be some of the preprint portals like Archive. BioArchive and other archives, so the ARXIV platforms. Those became very prominent during the pandemic where people were publishing those preprints and that became a very, you know, quick way of getting your content out. So at the moment, that's also a, you know, open infrastructure where you know, it's not owned by a company and things like that. And I think that's important for dissemination of information and equity supporting scholarly work.
Great. Oh, so maybe we could try to tie the things together a bit. So how do you see open infrastructure enabling the verification of data? What's the relationship there?
Yeah, so yeah, as we mentioned earlier, like FAIR is a principle. You can think of it as a guideline, but you do need the implementation in the infrastructure level and the service level. So that's where I think the open philosophy of open infrastructure will come in. So nowadays it's very simple to, you know, put up a portal, you know, create APIs, you know, submit your code to GitHub, and all of the things are there. But I think the infrastructure support, where that's where some of the governance, funding, and policy comes in. So that's where I think that's where some of the focus are a little bit missing. So we need to bring them together. And then you can say that, okay, if you have the FAIR principles in place, we can think about open infrastructure as a way to enabling FAIR. And again, like, not all the data needs to be open. There are use cases where, you know, you probably don't need to make your data open, but you can still support the open principles within your protocol, within your transfer of the data, and you can still make your data FAIR and still have those use cases satisfied. But you need to bring in the policy, governance, and technology together to make this work.
Fantastic. Well, I think that's a great place to that's a great summary, a great place to end up on. So, Sharif, thank you so much for that stimulating conversation.
Yeah, thank you. This was really fun, and I'm looking forward to the future episodes of FAIR Podcast as well.
Great, thank you. Okay, well, that's it for this episode. I hope you enjoyed the discussion. The FAIR Data Podcast is provided by FairDataPodcast.org and produced by Mehroz Ahmed. You can find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and Google Podcasts, and follow us on Twitter at FairDataPodcast and soon on Mastodon as well. New episodes are released every Wednesday at 8 a.m. Pacific, 11 a.m. Eastern, 4 p.m. UK and 5 p.m. Central European Time, and late in Asia Pacific. See you then.